The headlines: Russia warns that possible delivery of U.S.-made battle tanks to Ukraine would be a blatant provocation. U.S. President Joe Biden once again calls on Congress to ban assault weapons after back-to-back mass shootings across the country. And North Korea places the capital Pyongyang on a five-day lockdown over rising cases of an unspecified respiratory illness. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of third-generation Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine, saying the weapons would burn in Ukraine. Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has also reacted. He called the delivery of the tanks a blatant provocation against Moscow. Antonov also accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Moscow. The U.S. is poised to announce the start of the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. In the meantime, Germany has also bowed to pressure from Western allies and agreed to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine. Both countries are expected to announce the decision later today. In a video address, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said tanks transfer talks must end with a decision, adding that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. He reiterated his claim that Russia is planning a new wave of aggression, with the first signs being visible in the Donbass region. In recent weeks, Russia has also filled up pressure on the eastern Ukrainian town of Bakhmut, claiming a number of successes in its military campaign there. EU foreign ministers rubber stamp an additional 500 million euros in military support for Ukraine. This as peace activists call on the bloc's leaders to take a different approach. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional 500 million euro military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. President Joe Biden is once again urging Congress to ban assault weapons after back-to-back deadly shootings across the country.
And we're working out a number of things that we can and are going to be doing. So the bottom line here is that we got a lot to talk about. And yesterday, my buddy Dianne Feinstein introduced her Senate assault weapons ban. I am asking you all to send that to my desk as quickly as you can.
Several states, including California, Ohio, and Washington, have experienced shooting incidents in recent weeks. The deadliest unfolded in California, where three separate gun assaults left two dozen people dead. Figures from a research database, the Gun Violence Archive, show there have been more than 600 mass shootings in the United States in the last 3 years, almost two a day on average. Biden's push for a ban on assault weapons is not likely to bear results, as Republicans now in control of the House of Representatives are mostly opposed to such measures. The Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gives Americans the right to bear arms, and about a third of adults in the country say they personally own a gun. Also in the U.S., former Vice President Mike Pence is the latest high-ranking politician to be put into the spotlight for the discovery of classified documents. The files were found at Pence's Indiana residence and turned over to the FBI last week. His representative says a small number of records were accidentally boxed and transported to his home as he left office in 2021. It's not clear what information the documents contain. The discovery comes in the wake of similar revelations about classified material discovered in President Joe Biden's private office and also the Florida residence of former President Donald Trump. Records from each administration are supposed to be turned over to the legal custody of the U.S. National Archives during the presidential transition period. It's unlawful to knowingly remove or retain classified material. The U.S. administration has granted a license to Trinidad and Tobago to develop a major gas field located in Venezuela's territorial waters. The move marks a further easing of some of Washington's sanctions on Caracas. The U.S. Treasury said it issued the license at the request of Trinidad. The license allows the island nation to do business with Venezuela's heavily sanctioned state-run oil company, PDVSA. This, as a Venezuelan company, has found reserves of 4.2 trillion cubic feet in the area. U.S. officials say granting the license helps ensure energy security and reduces the region's reliance on energy resources from other countries, including Russia. Western countries have seen an increasing scarcity in oil and gas supplies, exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. The easing of oil sanctions on Venezuela is also seen as an extension of Western efforts to tap into the country's vast oil and gas reserves. Peru's president has called for a national truce to end weeks of unrest against the backdrop of demands for her resignation and fresh elections.
We call for a truce. We call the Congress, and now I call my dear homeland, for a national truce to establish the dialogue tables and, better still, to be able to set the agenda for each region and develop our peoples.
President Boluarte said she will not back down from the path of dialogue, peace, and unity. The Peruvian head of state ruled out resignation but said that she has no intention for remaining in power. Boluarte said weeks of deadly protests have resulted in more than $1.3 billion in damage. The protests in Peru began in December after then-President Pedro Castillo was arrested and replaced by his vice president, Dina Boluarte. Protesters also want Castillo released. Some 50 people have been killed during the disturbances. Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including the creation of a common currency. The announcement came as Brazilian President Lula da Silva visited Argentina on his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. The imposition of U.S. trade restrictions and sanctions against a number of countries, including Russia, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, Iraq, and Syria, have been ineffective and backfired against Western economies. As a result, the U.S. dollar has been losing its role as a major currency in international trade transactions. This provides a unique opportunity for regional currencies and alternative payment systems to fill the vacuum, just like what Argentina and Brazil are planning to do.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernández, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries, so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive.
North Korean authorities have ordered a five-day lockdown for the capital, Pyongyang, as the city is witnessing a rise in cases of an unspecified respiratory illness. A South Korean news outlet reported the measure, citing a notice from the North Korean government. The notice didn't mention COVID-19, but said residents were required to stay indoors until Sunday. They also have to submit temperature checks multiple times every day. The outlet had earlier reported that Pyongyang residents were appeared to be stocking up food and other essentials in anticipation of stricter measures. Pyongyang had acknowledged its worst coronavirus outbreak in 2022, but declared victory over the virus in October the same year. The North has never confirmed the exact number of COVID cases and related deaths. In the Philippines, an Air Force plane crash near the capital, Manila, leaves the pilot and another aviator dead. The aircraft was wrecked after hitting a rice field during training in the town of Pilar in Bataan Province. A military spokesman says a radar lost track of the aircraft 30 minutes after it took off. He said an investigation has been launched to identify the cause of the mishap. The crash comes as rescuers are searching for another plane that went missing in the Philippines' northern mountainous region. Six people, including the pilot, were on board. The search operation has temporarily been halted due to bad weather. Moving on, Iran's intelligence minister has reported the arrest of 12 terrorist teams affiliated with the Israeli spy agency Mossad in the country. Ismail Khatib said the terrorists were planning to carry out operations to avenge the failure of their seditious plots during the recent riots in Iran. He added that intelligence apparatuses could make all those plots futile and nab the terrorists in the short span of time. Khatib noted that Iran's enemies have been seeking to topple the Islamic establishment since the victory of the 1979 revolution. He said the intelligence ministry is always ready to neutralize enemy plots and threats. And Israel has demolished the home of a Palestinian man who was killed by the regime's forces months ago. According to media reports, Israeli forces raided the Shuafat refugee camp in the West Bank early on Wednesday in order to destroy the home of Uday Tamimi, who was shot dead in October. Tamimi was wanted in connection with the killing of an Israeli soldier in a retaliatory attack. Israel's regime regularly demolishes Palestinian homes under different pretexts, including attacks on Israeli forces and settlers. Human rights organizations condemn the Israeli act as collective punishment. The Tel Aviv regime has intensified its crackdown on Palestinians, killing 18 people in the West Bank this year alone. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Praise God! Wise, learned, intelligent, educated women like yourselves exist everywhere. And this group that is sitting here today is a sample of the population. You are a flower from a great floral garden. Praise God, we have a large number of discerning, judicious, educated, well-informed women all throughout the country. Thank God. That dream that we had about these young, pious girls growing up and becoming female scholars and scientists, praise God, that dream has been fulfilled. One of the important things that you need to do is the following. Expose the dreadful view of the Western culture toward the issue of gender and the issue of women. Tell everyone. Some people are unaware of it. There are some inside our country who do not know about it, and there are many outside the country who are unaware of it. They do not know about it in Islamic countries. Islamic countries have a thirst for learning about these kinds of things. The places which I have been to and where we are here, news of this has reached me that it is like this there. And tell the people in Western countries too.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today it is very easy to communicate using social media. You can communicate using the social media and lay the groundwork for them to pay attention to these matters. Discuss these concepts using short, expressive statements. Make statements that are both short and expressive, and then send them to increase awareness among general public. Use hashtags and things of that sort that exist. This is a great tool that is currently at your disposal. So this was one issue, the theoretical and practical view of Islam on the issue of men and women and the issue of gender. Another point with regard to the issue of women's affairs is the subject of family, which fortunately was brought up and discussed from several perspectives in these women's speeches today. It was very good. I really enjoyed their statements. You see, the formation of a family is the result of a general law in the universe, the general law of creation. That law is the law of pair, that is marriage.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States and yet again another shooting with mass fatalities. Around a dozen people were killed and about the same number were injured in a mass shooting in the largely Asian city of Monterey in Southern California. Eyewitnesses said the assailant opened fire indiscriminately with a semi-automatic weapon at an event in Monterey Park as the local community was celebrating Chinese Lunar New Year. Captain Andrew Mayer of L.A. Sheriff's Department said officers had responded to emergency calls at around 10:20 p.m. on Saturday and found people pouring out of the premises. He said the officers made entry to the location and located additional victims. Police say the victims were transported to numerous local hospitals and were listed in various conditions from stable to critical. Witnesses said there was a shooter with a machine gun who had multiple rounds of ammunition on him so he could reload. It is still unknown whether the suspect knew his victims or whether it was a targeted attack. Investigations are underway into the shooting to find out the motive behind it and whether or not the incident was a hate crime. But the factors that lead to tragedies like the one in Monterey Park are deeply ingrained in U.S. politics, culture, and law. As defined by the Gun Violence Archive, a mass shooting is an incident during which four or more people are shot. The Monterey incident is the 33rd such mass shooting that has taken place in the U.S. already since the beginning of this year. It follows shootings at an MLK Day celebration in Fort Pierce, Florida, and a shooting that killed six people in Goshen, California, on that very same day. The Monterey shooting also follows numerous such events last year, including at a Walmart in Virginia, the one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a shooting on a school bus allegedly targeting members of the University of Virginia football team, and a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois last summer. The United States experienced 647 mass shootings last year, illustrating the severity of the issue with guns. The mass shootings in the U.S. come as no other country has suffered such a high death toll from gun violence. Every day, more than 110 Americans die at the end of a gun, including suicides and homicides, an average of more than 40,000 per year. In 2020 alone, more than 45,000 Americans died at the end of a gun, whether by homicide or suicide, more than any other year on record. In terms of the number of incidents, since 2009, there has been an annual average of 19 shootings in which at least four people are killed. The U.S. gun homicide rate is as much as 26 times that of other high-income countries. Its gun suicide rate is nearly 12 times higher. This, as gun control opponents have typically framed the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. as a symptom of a broader mental health crisis. Every country has people with mental health issues and extremists. Those problems aren't unique. What is unique in the U.S.'s expansive view of civilian gun ownership, ingrained in politics, in culture, and in the law since the nation's founding, and a national political process that has so far proved incapable of changing that norm. In terms of the number of guns in the U.S. and how they contribute to the related violence, one estimate from the Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 390 90 million guns in circulation in the U.S. in 2018, or about 120.5 firearms per 100 residents. More recent data also suggests that gun ownership grew significantly over the last several years. One study published by the Annals of Internal Medicine in February found that 7.5 million U.S. adults, just under 3% of the population, became first new gun owners between January 2019 and April 2021. But what are the causes of gun violence in the U.S.? Easy access to firearms, a lack of comprehensive background checks and regulations, social and economic factors such as poverty, racism, and mental illness could be named as such. When it comes to the National Rifle Association, the NRA lobbies heavily against all forms of gun control and argues that more guns make the country safer. Despite years of financial woes and internal strife, the NRA remains the most powerful gun lobby in the United States, with a substantial budget to influence members of Congress on gun policy. In January, the NRA filed for bankruptcy as part of a fraud case against some of its own senior staff. Over the last several election cycles, the NRA and other organizations have consistently spent more on pro-gun rights messaging than their rivals in the gun control lobby. Who supports gun control? Despite widespread and vocal public outrage, often in the wake of gun violence, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014, according to polling by Gallup. 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. 11% surveyed said laws should be made less strict. Last year, Congress reached a deal on limited gun reforms for the first time in nearly 30 years, but the recent shootings underscored just how embedded gun violence is in the U.S. To the solutions. Some argue for stricter gun control laws, such as universal background checks, banning certain types of weapons, and increasing funding for mental health services. Others argue for a more permissive approach, such as loosening restrictions on gun ownership and emphasizing the importance of the Second Amendment.
Fractures are appearing in the Ukraine conflict between the Western backers of the war, first amongst themselves, then with Ukraine. Even though some 50 nations agreed to aid Kiev with billions of dollars worth of military hardware, including armored vehicle and munitions needed to push back Russian forces, Germany has refused to provide Ukraine with Leopard tanks. Not only that, it has prevented other nations from transferring these tanks to Ukraine by countries that have them in their possession. The new German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said that despite heightened expectations, we still cannot say when a decision will be taken and what the decision will be when it comes to the Leopard tanks. This has angered Ukraine, which blasted the global indecision of its allies after Germany's refusal. A Ukrainian presidential advisor tweeted, "Today's indecision is killing more of our people. Every day of delay is the death of Ukrainians. Think faster." It appears that the main disagreement lies between the U.S. and Germany, which has indicated that it would agree to do so only if the U.S. provided its Abrams tanks as well. Washington has said providing its Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. This disagreement has led to friction within the circle of U.S. congressmen. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has called on both countries to supply the machines. To the Germans, he said send the tanks to Ukraine because they need them. It is in your national interest that Russian President Vladimir Putin loses in Ukraine. To the U.S. President Joe Biden administration, he said send American tanks so that others will follow our lead. Military assistance to Ukraine has continued unabated in recent weeks and months. The headline reads, Europe is gearing up to send Western tanks to Ukraine. It almost sounds like the warring parties are just getting warmed up to the conflict, that the war has entered a new phase. One conclusion could be that Ukraine is losing the war on the ground, since it continues to seek more military assistance, and what it has received so far has not been enough to defeat the Russian forces. This, however, will not deter NATO and a number of individual member states who have pledged to provide heavier weapons to Ukraine. U.S.'s cautious stance may be that it does not want to fall into a direct conflict with Russia. That could also mean that it may risk defeat, or that this risks getting into a nuclear confrontation. Russia's reaction to countries that are going to provide Ukraine with tanks was a warning. Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, has said Kiev's foreign backers do not care about Ukrainian lives and are motivated by their desire to hurt Russia. Those tanks can burn and will burn like the rest of the weapons. The nations supplying them are using Ukraine as an instrument in achieving their anti-Russian goals. Russia has also stated that this is no longer a war between Russia and Ukraine, but a war between Russia and US and NATO. But what the Ukrainian defense minister said has been very telling. He tweeted recently, "We are carrying out NATO's mission today. They aren't shedding their blood. We are shedding ours. That's why they are required to supply us with weapons." All that brings everyone to the question, when will Ukrainians realize their country is being sacrificed for the sake of the US weakening Russia?
Zamir Kabulov, Russia's presidential envoy to Afghanistan, says that the U.S. has been reaching out to the Taliban's opposition groups, such as Daesh, and secretly giving money to them. He describes the reasoning for this covert support as such: because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation, they do everything so that peace isn't established in this troubled land. He further linked this move to Russia's security by saying, with the armed opposition in Afghanistan, the Anglo-Saxons are covertly sponsoring Daesh, who are aimed at undermining not only the stability of our Central Asian partners, but also the security of Russia. Allegations of the U.S. supporting Daesh in particular have been around for a decade at this point. Sometimes they even come from U.S. officials.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, crooked Hillary Clinton.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is among the top officials that accused the United States of backing Daesh. Erdogan made the accusations in response to U.S. accusations against his government for supporting terrorist groups. He said, "Now they give support to terrorist groups including Daesh, YPG, PYD. It is very clear. We have confirmed evidence with pictures, photos, and videos." In a three-year field study into the supply chain of Daesh, it was found that the arming and external funding that anti-Assad rebel groups received from the U.S. found their way into the hands of Daesh. With all the accusations on America's direct involvement in the founding of Daesh, the indirect involvement that most of the world agrees resulted in the creation of the terror group is the quote-unquote power vacuum that the U.S. left in the region by fighting the many wars it fought, especially the invasion of Iraq and the support of Syrian rebel groups. The U.S. effectively fought a war in Afghanistan for 20 years with a budget of over $2.1 trillion to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. The Taliban has been accused of many things since their swift power grab back in August of 2021, But what they have managed to do is stabilizing the country and ridding it of power struggles. That means groups like Daesh, who still have a presence in the region, weren't able to establish bases in Afghanistan, despite still carrying out terrorist attacks for a while after Taliban's takeover, the number of which have significantly dropped over the last year. Now, with around 97% of the population of Afghanistan below poverty line, and with half of the country's billions of dollars worth of foreign assets frozen by the U.S., the last thing the country can afford is U.S. shenanigans trying to prop up Takfiri terrorist groups there. Recently, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken poured salt on the wounds of Afghanistan by justifying the way the U.S. left Afghanistan by saying, if the forces had remained there, quote, it would have, I think, made much more complicated the support that we've been able to give and that others have been able to give Ukraine. Almost as if Afghanistan was a pawn in the grand scheme of U.S.'s political agendas, an attitude that isn't too uncommon in U.S. politics with all of their friends and foes. Instances of such attitude are numerous. From the promise of retaliation to Saudi Arabia over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and then doing nothing about it because Saudi Arabia is a strategic partner to the U.S., to using Taiwan as a means to get under China's skin that could lead to a conflict wherein Taiwan will turn into a pawn for U.S.'s political games.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has held a press briefing to give an update on the ongoing war in Ukraine. In his press briefing, which was held in Moscow on Wednesday, Lavrov accused Ukraine's foreign policy of being under the dictation of Western nations. The Russian top diplomat further noted that Western nations have yet to make, quote, serious proposals to Russia on how the conflict should be resolved. Lavrov added that Russia was willing to support a draft truce proposed by Ukraine in late March, but the proposal was destroyed by Ukraine's Western supporters. He also said, in reality, the West decides for Ukraine what its foreign policy should be. Western officials have repeatedly claimed that arming Ukraine would help it achieve a better negotiation position and that no talks with Russia should take place before this happens. Lavrov further said Moscow would react to any serious proposal for overcoming the crisis that come from the US and its allies, but none has been sent so far. He also added that the West is using Ukraine to destroy the security system that existed in Euro-Atlantic for many years. Lavrov's comments come amid deepening crisis in Ukraine. On Wednesday, a helicopter crash killed Ukraine's interior minister, his deputy, and the state secretary of the ministry. The deaths have been described as a huge blow for Ukraine. The United States and its Western allies are also ramping up their support for Ukraine. Reports say Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, met for a couple of hours with Ukraine's chief military officer, General Valery Zaluzhny, in Poland. This is the first face-to-face talks between them since the war began in February 2022. The meetings are expected to focus on Ukraine's ongoing and future military needs. The United Kingdom has also pledged a squadron of its Challenger tanks, but it has too few to form the basis of a Ukrainian force. The moves by the United States and the UK come amid an apparent rift in the anti-Russia coalition.
Well, last year it was $2.3 billion, and from financial year 2023, we'll put in another $2.3 billion. Some of that is non-military aid, some of that is, you know, the likes of humanitarian support, such as generators. Some of that is obviously military hardware. Some of it is training. We train 10,000 we trained Ukrainians in the UK, and we'll train another 20,000 in the UK, and some of it is effectively backfilling British stock.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has named Boris Pistorius as the country's new defence minister at a time of mounting pressure on Berlin from Western allies to allow Ukraine to use German-made tanks in the war with Russia. However, Germany says when it comes to sending tanks to Ukraine, Berlin is still waiting for the US to take the lead.
And this is the strategy we have, that we are strategically interlocked together with our friends and partners, that we are working together with them, that we are discussing with them, and that we are never doing something just by ourselves, but together with others, especially the United States, which are very important in this common task to defend the Ukrainian independence and sovereignty.
Germany is under pressure to participate in a broader alliance of countries that will supply Ukraine's army with modern Leopard 2 battle tanks. The previous German defense minister, Christine Lambrecht, was a loyal defender of Chancellor Scholz's cautious tank stance. Analysts said the delay so far has to do with disagreements amongst Western countries about the lethality of the weapons Ukraine needed. Russia has denounced the Western weapons supplies. Officials say Ukraine's allies were using the country as a tool to achieve their anti-Russian goals. Kremlin says the tanks that the UK pledged will burn just like the rest.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The fans.
Football is one of the most lucrative businesses in our time. Not many industries can overtake it. Football is the most powerful non-media phenomenon in the world. All tycoons and influential people want to have control over it. Football is the most important news in the world. All cameras are fixed on the green field. Think about it a little. What can you find in this world that's not tied to football? We can't shut our eyes. Football is everywhere. It's so conspicuous and omnipresent that you cannot deny it. Fans and spectators, the strongest impetus for football. Just imagine for a moment what would have happened if football didn't enjoy such a huge popular support. This is a rule. The larger the number of the people who are engaged in a phenomenon, the more significant the phenomenon will be. Football gets its power from the cheering of the fans. But why do people become fans? Wherever in the world 22 people run after a ball, some spectators will definitely show up. In some places, fewer people, and in some other places, more people. And sometimes, there is such a huge crowd of spectators and fans that it hinders the match. For example, in the final match of the knockout games in Britain in 1923, over 300,000 people stormed the stadium. Many other matches in the history of the sport had so many spectators that they had to sit up to the sidelines. Fans, whether it's stadiums or in front of TV screens or monitors, will be an integral part of matches and events related to them. They jump up and down, they cry, they shout, and get mad as far as getting a heart attack. They swear They fight, they cause mayhem, and sometimes they even get killed. The spectators cheer their favorite teams and players and give them energy. Sometimes they do it so well, it leads to a comeback. The spectators boo the rival team's players and make them nervous. Even if it's necessary, they disrupt the games. As it's always said, they're the 12 players of their team. That's why all players and coaches share their happiness with them, because football spectators are not just watchers of a sports match. For those who watch matches under scorching heat or heavy snow, football is no joke. They love football. But what do people want from football? Why do they arrange everything in their lives based on football? The first answer is this: entertainment. Football is the best entertainment in the world. You only need to watch it to feel the miracle, the beauty of the techniques, the excitement of the sideline issues, the amazing tactics, and eventually, the display of fate. You can find everything in football. Everything you need for happiness, sadness, surprise, or excitement. Even in the most boring matches, there are things that will make you remember them for weeks. After all, people always want to be entertained. That's why they watch movies or go on vacations or do thousands of other things. Football gives them this gift. What's more entertaining than being at a stadium and watching the most beautiful sport by mankind? But more importantly is the feeling of it. When people enter the stadium, they become members of a big society, a group with the same flag and colors, with the same slogans, the same goal, the same idea, and the same wish. You become united with thousands of people at the stadiums who sing the same song or laugh and cry for the same thing. It satisfies one of human beings' most basic needs, the tendency to socialize, the need to be united with others, the instinct to communicate with a group without the usual expenses for social relationships. Being a part of a coordinated society is the best feeling in the world. It's a feeling of sameness and cordiality, a feeling of esprit de corps. And the third reason is what we call catharsis.
Most amazing Champions League night this great crowd has ever seen. It's the greatest ever semi-final comeback in the history of the competition. Liverpool are into the final, and we will never ever forget quite how they did it.
Catharsis is the feeling the audience gets after listening to a masterpiece symphony or watching an impressive play. It's a kind of revolution inside you. It's a kind of spiritual experience. Football is a small example of our life. so merciless, so beautiful, and so fair. The most sorrowful tragedies, along with surprises, achievements, and epics. The biggest protagonists, next to the most detested antagonists, in the most spectacular clashes. Watching football makes you feel that you're part of a bigger experience, a part of the common experience by human beings whose identity is exactly similar to our life. The experience of watching a good match is just like watching a play by Shakespeare. You have a strange feeling afterwards, a kind of pleasant lightness. People watch football for these things. The importance of the spectators can't be realized anywhere as much as in the World Cup. The World Cup is the most important event in the world of football. It's a headline of all the media in the world. Billions of people across the world watch it. All nations follow it. That's why a national team's participation in the World Cup is the biggest dream for its fans. They support their teams months ahead of the games, in World Cup qualification games, in friendlies, in practice sessions, and even at the airports. They're always everywhere, and they accompany their teams in the breathtaking path towards the World Cup. If a country's national team isn't used to regularly taking part in the World Cup, they hold large celebrations on the streets after qualification. Fans boost the players' spirits along the way to prepare for the World Cup. And they get ready and go to the stadiums on the other side of the planet to shout their country's names and support the players. This is a climax of human beings' love for football. Fans at stadiums are draped with their country's flags. Sometimes they paint their faces as the color of their flags. Sometimes they even bring symbols of their country and history to the stadiums. And it doesn't stop there. They have bizarre devices for cheering, sing long songs out loud. They have similar appearances and fantasy designs. It all turns the World Cup into a passionate and colorful carnival of different cultures. It's a chance for dialogue among civilizations, languages, religions, and human beings. The performance of the fans is the most representative of their nation's cultures. Japanese and South Korean fans are well-disciplined, indefatigable, and coordinated. Brazilians are full of energy and joy, and they never stop cheering their team. And the Britain's strategy to cheer their players is exactly what's dragged other nations into conflicts. The different cultures and approaches of cheering will be in the minds of everyone in the world for many years. It'll somehow become an image from the people in that country in the minds of the people in the world. As everyone knows the tiny country of Iceland with their fans' unique cheering, or the Vuvuzelas in the 2010 World Cup quickly found their ways to football matches everywhere in the world, or the Mexican Wave, which has been ongoing in big stadiums since 1986. Apart from all of these, World Cup fans have another major characteristic as well. They gather under the same national flag. Their most important goal is to support their national pride and gaining pride for the flag. The flag isn't tied to the identity of any club or individual. When a club loses, its fans might get upset for months, but when a national team loses, a country loses. Millions of people's national pride and their sports credibility are hurt. To be honest, the World Cup is a peaceful example of wars that's been fought between countries for centuries. Nowadays, countries don't fight each other with their missiles. They line up with their players and fans. Everything is like wars in the past. 11 players as the fighters at the forefront and tens of thousands of fans as infantry behind them. The goal is to hoist the flag that covers all of them. Just think about the match between Argentina and Britain in the 1986 World Cup and what it meant for thousands of Argentine spectators at the Estadio Azteca in Mexico 4 years after their defeat in the Falklands War. Then you'll realize the crazy excitement of the spectators at the stadium. Or think about the spectators of the match between Iran and the U.S. at the Gerland Stadium and how they felt when both nations' flags were raised side by side. This is the main factor that differentiates spectators in a World Cup match from an ordinary match. The former aren't looking for excitement, they're looking for honor. They're trying to display their nation's culture. They're trying to immerse in the shadow of the flag to which they owe many things. The history of the World Cup is replete with spectators that if it wasn't for them, nothing in these matches would look like what it is now. The spectators are the soul of the World Cup. Think about July 16, 1950, the final match with the largest number of spectators in history, when 200,000 Brazilian spectators were cheering their team like mad. When the biggest tragedy in the history of the country's football happened. Later on, in the 1970 World Cup, being a spectator had the meaning we know today. In most of the matches, over 80,000 people were at the stadiums, and some of them over 120,000 people. Many of them were foreigners. The huge numbers of spectators changed the face of many things. Television networks were now interested in broadcasting the matches. If the World Cup could take thousands of people from all across the world to a country, then why wouldn't it make millions of people sit in front of TV screens? Meanwhile, the large crowds would put a huge pressure on the referees in a way that the referees would make strange mistakes in favor of the hosts. It was that year when the world realized that the presence of so many spectators would give their country's tourism industry a boost. The high numbers of spectators changed the history of the World Cup. Now, the spectators were not just people who were sitting on the sidelines to watch the matches. They were an important part of the competition. They could impact everything. When Austria and Germany played in 1982 in a match that was suspected to be a match-fixing, the fans at the stadium found out about it. They got so angry that they showed the players of both teams banknotes throughout the match as a sign of protests. Some of them even set their national flags on fire. The protests drew everyone's attention to the historical scandal. In the following years, in the final matches of the 1990 World Cup, the Italian spectators piled so much pressure on Maradona, who had defeated their team, to disturb him so he couldn't display his best show. They grabbed the cup from Argentina and gave it to Germany. When Maradona was shedding tears with a silver medal around his neck, the Italians seemed satisfied. And in the 2002 World Cup, we witnessed how South Korean fans pushed the referees to the most horrible mistakes. In fact, in the hell that the South Korean fans made, it was very hard not to make any mistakes.